She thought of black-eyed Lois in Reseda, who had seemed like a gypsy, reading a fate in Jane's eyes.
You want to die? So go die.
She desired only sleep, now, and justice, soon. She didn't want vodka, but sleep wouldn't come without it. She mixed a drink. She didn't want to die. Hell no. What that woman had seen in her eyes was dread. A shrinking, anxious fear of what waited on the 8th floor of the Far Horizons building, what Randall Larkin had told her waited there. Neither the hard training at Quantico nor years of even harder experience could adequately prepare her for such a confrontation. Maybe the crying child whom she'd heard this night had been herself all those years earlier, when she had found her mother dead in the blood-clouded water of the bathtub. Chapter 21. Parked across the street from Far Horizons, Jane Hawk watched employees coming to work Tuesday morning. Some carpooled. She noted the license plate numbers of those who commuted alone. From Randall Larkin, she knew that each employee was assigned a numbered parking space and accessed the garage when a laser reader scanned a hologram sticker affixed to the windshield. Visitors had to arrange for admittance 24 hours in advance. Later, at a library, using a public access computer, she opened the DMV records with a police code, identified the owners of those vehicles, and obtained the addresses on their registration forms. By noon, she had two candidates. Sarah Laura Schoen lived in a duplex in Sausalito and came to work over the Golden Gate Bridge. Henry Waldlock lived in Pacifica, south of the city. As best Jane could tell by their Facebook pages and other social media, neither was married or in a relationship. Both used matchmaking services. Because Henry had a single-family house that suggested greater privacy than a duplex, Jane drove to Pacifica to scout the place. The residence stood on a heavily landscaped, oversized lot and was the last house on the street, ideal for her intentions. After eating an early dinner at a restaurant, she returned to Henry's neighborhood and parked the SUV two streets removed from the one on which he lived. Carrying her tote, she walked to his lovely Spanish Revival house and rang the bell at 5:15. No one answered. Prominently staked in a planting bed of red impatience to the left of the front steps, a foot-square alarm company sign warned that the premises were protected. Neighbors on the north, none to the south. The south side gate featured a gravity latch. She let herself through and followed a walkway between the garage and a property line wall covered with espaliered jasmine vines. At the side door to the garage, she sat on the walkway, screened from the street by the gate, and waited. At 6:11, not long after dark, engine noise was followed by arcing headlights. A car pulled into the driveway, not visible from Jane's position. The roll-up door rumbled. The alarm sounded. The car drove into the garage, and the door rolled down again. The alarm fell silent while the car was still running. He must have switched it off with his phone. As Jane got to her feet, lights came on in the house, also phone-controlled by Henry. He killed the engine. A car door slammed. He whistled on the way between his BMW 740i sedan and the connecting door to the house. When she heard the inner door close, Jane forced open the side door to the garage. She didn't need the lock aid. She loaded the simple latch with one of her driver's licenses. The timer-controlled lamp on the door lift still provided soft light. Beside the BMW stood a candy-apple-red 1960 Corvette. The garage was clean and without clutter. Like most people with security systems, Henry didn't engage the perimeter alarm when he was home. Good for Jane, bad for him. He also neglected to lock the door between house and garage. She stepped into a laundry room, then into a ground-floor hallway. Lights in the kitchen. Audience laughter as a TV came to life. Carrying her tote, she went upstairs. She settled into the darkness of the spare bedroom farthest from the master suite. After dinner, Henry watched a movie at such volume that the walls vibrated. Maybe giant robots, alien invaders, interminable. Considering his Facebook postings, his use of a matchmaking service, and his lonely evening, she felt some sympathy for him. Nevertheless, she would take him down and take his car. When he went to bed at 10 o'clock, he set the security system. The recorded voice announced, "Armed to home." He'd activated the perimeter alarm, not the motion detectors. There was no reason to suppose he'd become suddenly suspicious in the middle of the night, but she braced the door with a straight-backed chair before stretching out on the bed. Oppressed by thoughts of the gauntlet awaiting her on the 8th floor, she had no concern about sleeping later than Henry. She woke repeatedly and got up at 4:05 a.m., removed the tipped chair from under the doorknob, went into the hallway. The moon at a window cast pale light perfect for haunting. She stopped at the open door to the master suite. Henry snored softly. Switching on her penlight, she entered. He was lying face up. When she pumped the little spray bottle and spritzed the lower part of his face with chloroform, he twitched. His eyes fluttered open, but then he transitioned from one kind of sleep to another. He was wearing only briefs, maybe 150 pounds. Dead weight, yet she got him off the bed, dragged him by his arms. When he regained consciousness, he sat naked on the master bath toilet in a windowless water closet, as isolated as any place in the house. His wrists were secured to each other with multiple windings of duct tape and were bound to his left thigh with more yards of tape. Heavy-duty plastic cable zips shackled his ankles, and a chain of those sturdy ties wrapped the base of the toilet, linking to the shackles. A cable zip encircled his neck, and a chain of them linked the neck restraint to the ankle shackles. Duct tape sealed his lips. His briefs hung from the doorknob where he could see them. He cast off the effects of the chloroform quicker than Jane thought possible. He couldn't imagine how he had gotten where he was. Shock and fear and mortification cleared his head, and a fine sweat broke out on his brow and upper lip. Standing in the open doorway, Jane said, "Are you with me?" He made a confirming sound through the duct tape. "Just to be sure, I'll give you another couple minutes. Your life is at stake. It's only fair to be sure you understand." For those 2 minutes, his eyes never left her. "Okay, Henry. Here's the thing. Maybe you're just an ordinary worker bee at Far Horizons. You don't know to what sick purpose all this research is being put. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. That's why you're not already dead. Got that?" He nodded. "Good boy. Now I'm going to take your car to Far Horizons, do a little business. When I come back, I'll free you, unhurt. Only you can get yourself killed, Henry. You know how these cable zips work?" He shook his head, then nodded, then shrugged. "I'll explain. You can draw them as tight as you want, and then tighter, but they can't be loosened. It's the way the little teeth on them are designed. Tighter, yes. Looser, no. Like a ratchet. It's as simple as Sesame Street. Understand?" He nodded. "A quick learner. Excellent. Now, Henry, I've left a finger's width of space between the zip around your neck and your skin. Tight, but not too tight. However, if you struggle to free yourself from the duct tape or shackles, I've connected these so your straining will draw the zip tighter around your throat. See how I've applied the ratchet principle to the problem of keeping you from escaping?" He nodded. "Good. Good. Good. That's why we need to learn new things, Henry. Not just to know them, but to apply the knowledge properly. So if I hadn't warned you about this, Henry, you might have made such a fierce effort that the zip would dig painfully into your flesh before you realized what was happening. If then you struggled further, struggled desperately, well, what would happen then? Would your situation improve or deteriorate? What do you think? He tried to say deteriorate through the duct tape. Yes, that's right. You have come such a long way in such a short time, Henry. Now I'm going to take the duct tape off your mouth. If you scream or shout for help, I'll hurt you very badly, and no one will have heard your scream anyway. Henry, are you able to imagine what I might mean by hurt you very badly? He nodded. Good boy. Let's see if you're as smart as you seem to be. She peeled the duct tape off his mouth. Henry drew a deep breath, shuddered as he exhaled, and issued a rush of words. I'm a cost control analyst. I budget, bargain with suppliers. I don't know much about the research. Hell's bells, I don't understand any of it. She stared at him in silence. Then, I didn't come here to ask for your job description. Are you done with self-justifications? I'm just saying. He fell silent when she drew one of the Heckler & Koch 45 compacts from the double-carry rig under her sport coat. Just answer my questions truthfully, and you'll be teacher's pet, Henry. Do you have a housekeeper?
Yes.
What days does she come in?
Wednesday. Today. 9 o'clock. That's why this won't work. You picked the wrong day.
On your Facebook page, Henry, you sometimes brag about your lifestyle. You're very smooth at it. You make it amusing. And maybe you don't even think of it as bragging, although that's what it is. You call your housekeeper a maid. From what I've read, she comes in twice a week, Monday and Thursday. Has her schedule changed, Henry? He hesitated.
No.
And what is today?
Wednesday.
So you've already lied to me once. Do you know what happens if you lie to me twice, Henry?
Yeah. I guess so.
What will that be?
You'll hurt me.
She waited.
Very badly,
he added. Better. I know that when you pull up to the garage gate at Far Horizons, a laser reader scans the sticker on your car windshield, then the gate opens. On which of the three levels do you park?
The first space. Space 23. Numbers on the wall. When you go through the gate, turn right. Then the space is on your left.
There's the good boy I knew you could be. You gave me 5 answers without making me ask 5 questions. The entry protocols are automated. But is there a guard at the garage, too? Someone who will see it's not you in that beamer?
No. Human beings are fallible. Technology is more reliable. We have cameras in the garage, but that's just for a video record. The only way to go up from the garage is by elevator, and the elevator requires everyone boarding it to speak their name.
Voice recognition ID?
Yeah. Plus your face is scanned. Facial recognition. You're not going anywhere from the garage. Not anywhere. Whatever you're after, you're finished before you start. You should have done better research. There's no point to all this shit.
We'll see. She holstered the pistol. She picked up a roll of duct tape from the floor and wound the length of it 3 times around his head, sealing his mouth shut. There. Now. I like you much better this way. Chapter 22. During the night, the massive storm front had come down the coast of Oregon, gathering moisture from the sea, until the sky was a sea itself, in search of a shore to break upon. Standing on its storied hills, San Francisco raised its shining towers and spires, bright and proud, before the pending tempest. Whether here was the new Atlantis, beyond all risk of submergence, or Babylon erected on shadows mistaken for bedrock, only time could know. The steep streets had never before troubled Jane Hawk, but in the foreboding light of day, waiting to be drowned, each climb seemed to lead to a precipice, and each descent threatened to become a plummet. although, of course, neither the city nor its inclines were what she feared. The previous day, employees of Far Horizons had arrived in two waves, the first at 8 o'clock, the second at 9. She timed her approach so that she descended the driveway from the street at 9:10, when few people were still in the garage. She didn't see the laser that read the windshield sticker, but the gate decoupled from its electronic locks and rolled aside, and she drove into the uppermost of the three subterranean floors. Space 23 was unoccupied, and she parked in it. When she got out of the BMW, she was aware of only two other people, both heading toward the elevators and paying her no heed. The cool air smelled faintly of the lime in the concrete walls, floor, and ceiling. The lingering exhaust fumes were more pungent. The pop-out in the middle of the south wall, which Wilson Faucheur had identified for her, was flanked by two parking spaces. The deadbolt lock succumbed quickly to the lock-release gun. Beyond lay a closet about 6 feet wide and 4 deep. She switched on the light and stepped inside and shut the door. To her left and right, foot-deep shelves held large cans of cleaning supplies and sealants. Floor-to-ceiling perf board covered the 4 feet of back wall between the flanking shelves, and from it hung two push brooms and half a dozen other tools of the janitorial trade. None of the cans appeared to have been opened, and none was stained by drips. The push brooms and other tools were new. The closet looked less like one used by maintenance personnel than like a presentation display of products, or a masquerade to disguise the true purpose of the space. After some consideration, she took down the push brooms and other tools and set them aside and studied the wall. The hangers from which the various objects had depended were stainless steel with shanks that disappeared into holes in the perf board. She tried removing them. They were permanently fixed. Of the 8 hangers, however, 2 turned like doorknobs. 1 turned 360 degrees to the left. Click. The hanger beside the first one turned 360 degrees to the right. Click. A motor purred, and the wall swung away from her, and light swelled to replace the darkness beyond. She stepped onto a landing at the foot of a staircase. Not spiral. Switchback. This side of the false wall was not covered in perf board, and it featured a lever-style handle for easy exit. She closed it and heard the lock engage. She tried the handle, and the door opened, and she let it close again. The landing floor, stair risers, and treads were covered in a pale gray rubbery material to afford sure and quiet footing. The walls and ceiling were of drywall painted white, and the light came from inlaid panels overhead. The only places that cameras could have been concealed were behind the lenses of the fluorescent light panels, but they were heavily frosted, defeating any monitor. Wilson Faucheur evidently was right when he'd said the electronic security system and the architectural one would not overlap. She had previously screwed sound suppressors onto both pistols. She drew 145 now and started sideways up the stairs, her back to the outer wall, so she would get as early a look at each landing as possible. The pistol in a two-hand grip, arms extended. The quiet pooled so deep that it seemed to have substance, filling the stairs as water filled a real well. No suggestion that her presence might be known. No adversary in sight. But she was in the labyrinth of the beast, and something worse lay ahead than just the Minotaur with its taste for human flesh. 2 flights of stairs and 1 interim landing per floor. No exit door at the ground floor. None at the second. None at the third. By every indication, this was indeed the secret route by which DJ Michael could escape the building in a crisis. Cautiously, zigzagging upward, landing by landing. The lighting was so evenly distributed that she cast no shadow. some dreams unfolded in such a shadowless silence. Only the rhythmic systole of her heart confirmed that she was not lost in sleep. On the 8th floor, she arrived at the first door, white in a white wall. If Randall Larkin had known what he was talking about, this exit would not be locked. Anyone who found these hidden stairs, either by accident or intention, was welcome to open this door and take her chances with what lay beyond. She continued to the 9th floor, just to ascertain that the door there was as formidable as she had been told. It was slightly larger than a regular door, a solid slab of steel, no less daunting than a bank vault door, surrounded by a single-piece cast steel frame. The wall in which it was set would be perhaps 2 feet of concrete and rebar, embedded as well with a matrix of metal fibers, able to withstand even a shaped charge of C4. That DJ took these extreme measures to protect himself revealed a paranoia commensurate with his sociopathic lust for power. But was it really paranoia, considering that she had gotten to this threshold with the intention of forcing him to confess his crimes and seal his destruction? Or was it only prudence? A man might be mad, and yet prudent in his madness. When he hoped to transform the entire world, rewrite all of history to his liking, and make himself a god among men, he was wise to expect that there would be those who resisted, as there had been throughout history, though too often those who'd resisted totalitarianism had triumphed late, and often as much by chance as by design. She didn't ascend to the 10th floor, sure that it would have a door like that on the 8th. She descended from the 9th and came again to the target floor. She stood with her back to the wall, beside a door as plain as any she had ever seen, and yet it was an entrance to pandemonium, where the demons of past superstitions were made real, where there was no way but the way of violence, where the actions of even the righteous must be judged good only according to how much blood of others she spilled. The first enemy she met would be Rayshaw's. Bertold Schenck, inventor of the nanotech command mechanism, had named them Rayshaw's after the brainwashed character Raymond Shaw in The Manchurian Candidate, the novel by Richard Condon. She had encountered their like before, on Schenck's 70-acre ranch in Napa Valley, on the day that he and his hateful wife had been paid the death they'd earned. The Rayshaws provided security at the ranch. They were the equivalent of the Aspasia girls, their memories and personalities dissolved by webs of control mechanisms woven through their brains, reduced to machines of blood and bone with one programmed purpose. The girls of Aspasia were as lithe and irresistible as succubi, every technique of seduction and sexual pleasure downloaded into them, along with the command to be at all times submissive. The Rayshaws were instead killing machines, heedless of their safety, fearless, because the concept of their own mortal nature had been scrubbed from their minds, even as they were encoded to slaughter whomever their masters wanted dead. According to Randall Larkin, and confirmed by the blueprints Wilson had reviewed with Jane, the 8th floor contained 2 small apartments and otherwise 8,000 square feet of undeveloped space. One apartment housed 4 Rayshaws who never left this level of the building, who spent their days in exercise and simple games of cards in which they were programmed to find adequate stimulation. For the moment, Jane returned the pistol to its holster. From the Velcro attachment system of the Gould and Goodrich gun belt, she plucked a stun grenade, a flashbang disabler that was a standard tool in a SWAT arsenal, which she had obtained in Reseda when she'd acquired the belt itself. She reached across the door and gripped the lever handle with her left hand. Travis, in hiding. Nick, in the grave. So make the bastards pay for that. She pushed open the door, which activated lights in the space beyond, popped the flashbang, threw it hard toward the back of what the blueprints called undeveloped space, and retreated, pulling the door almost shut to shield herself from the effects of the grenade. The flash strobed through the crack between door and jamb, and the bang surely was heard by DJ up on the 9th floor, if not by those on a couple floors below this one. As she swung the door inward in the aftermath and drew a pistol, Jane felt the residual vibrations in her teeth that must still be jittering in the bones of the four Rayshaws and briefly disrupting their nerve path messaging. She entered low and fast, undeveloped space to both sides, one of the two apartments far to her left, a long blank wall with what might have been a metal slab door, and the other far to her right, where an ordinary door stood open. Between her and that apartment were three of the four Rayshaws. They had come running when she first alerted them by opening the door from the stairs, one now on his side on the floor, having dropped his gun, another fallen to his knees and disoriented but still armed, the third staggering toward her. Ahead and behind her were windows looking out onto the balcony that encircled the building. Beyond the balcony, the city, thrust toward a dire sky clotted with the unspent storm. And overhead, suspended from the 14-foot-high ceiling, was a geometric orchestration of 2-inch diameter grab bars at various heights, extending the width of the building, on which the greater threat would come. Chapter 23. Jane, in a half-crouch, scoping the situation on the move. She squeezed off three shots, targeting the kneeling man, giving him no chance because he was not a man but a kneeling thing that had once been a man, and he collapsed in a judgment of blood like a penitent whose confession was rejected by some angry god. No room here for empathy or pity, which would result only in her death. Even as the kneeler gave up his first gout of blood, Jane intuited the reaction of the staggering Rayshaw, dropped flat as he sprayed bullets with a sound-suppressed fully automatic pistol, pumping out the contents of an extended magazine, maybe 16 rounds, his aim thrown high and wide, screwed by his flashbang disorientation. Slugs ricocheted off the brushed steel grab bars overhead, slapped off thick bulletproof windows, leaving milky kiss marks on the glass, keened sharply off the concrete floor in sprays of chips, scores of near misses as the rounds spent their energy with each deflection. The staggering Rayshaw staggered to a stop, fumbling with a fresh magazine, maybe 20 seconds into it now. Jane up, moving boldly but not running, arms extended with the 45, focused on the front sight and the big man. No, he's an it. A thing. Two of her four shots carved away part of its neck, broke its face open, and showered the life out of it, a horror that would rock forever her dreams to come. The Rayshaw that had been sprawled flat by the stun grenade, that had dropped its weapon, became clear-headed enough to grab for the gun. Two rounds left in the heckler. One miss. One was a score, a leg wound. The Rayshaw gazed up at her, femur shattered by the hollow-point round, yet no expression on its broad, pale face, neither pain, nor rage, nor fear, but a terrible blankness, at best a robotic semblance of dumb determination. With the depleted heckler in her left hand, she snatched up the thing's gun with her right, finished it with three rounds, more than she needed for the job. She had been moving too fast for fear to catch up with her until this instant, but now she was in the grip of fright, spending bullets as if they were guarantors of survival. Three Rayshaws dead, one remaining. But where was it? The advantage given her by the flashbang diminishing by the second, her heart slamming in expectation of its sudden stoppage. Outside, the day flared as if with a Hiroshima moment, a flood of Armageddon light washing through the armored windows, seemingly bright enough to imprint her startled shadow forever on the wall. A doom crack of thunder spoke shudders through the building, as if its voice had come from deep in the unstable earth, and in its grumbling wake, Jane heard a lesser rumble that iced her spine as the mere storm breaking over the city could never have done. She saw the fourth Rayshaw then, in the doorway of their apartment, perhaps 20 yards away. 6'5" and solid and grim and radiant of menace, as if it were a lunatic assemblage of body parts from myriad cadavers stitched together and animated by the storm, a pistol in one hand and some device in the other, maybe a remote control, that it pointed toward the farther end of the undeveloped space. The Rayshaw seemed to be looking past Jane rather than at her, and she turned her head to see what it saw, the source of the lesser rumble. The door of the other apartment, which might more accurately be called a pen, a cage, was rolling aside in its metal tracks. Chapter 24. Given a choice, Jane would have welcomed coyotes, rabid or not, in almost any number, rather than what came forth into the killing ground of the eighth floor. Weeks earlier, at Berthold Schenck's ranch in Napa Valley, in addition to the Rayshaws, security also had been provided by coyotes with brain implants. An early experiment in the reliability of the technology, those prairie wolves could be controlled by microwave broadcast commands. Although they lived most of the time as ordinary animals, they could be called to attack with great ferocity. DJ Michael had been inspired to impress a different species into service on the 8th and 10th floors of his building. Several years earlier, the nation had been horrified and transfixed by the news story of a pet chimpanzee that, in a rage, had attacked the woman next door, biting off her fingers, tearing off her face, and disfiguring her further in ways unthinkable, leaving her grievously disabled and comatose, all in less than a minute. The chimpanzees of movie and TV fame, adored by the public for their cute antics, were mostly pygmy chimps. A full-size male chimpanzee, weighing 120 pounds, with its long arms and athletic prowess, was far quicker than the quickest man, and stronger than a human being more than twice its size. Unlike gorillas, chimpanzees were omnivores, eating everything from berries to insects to small animals. As Poe knew when he wrote The Murders in the Rue Morgue, which featured an orangutan, a creature that had tasted blood was more likely to draw blood, and within certain primates, not just in human beings, there was a capacity for rage and violence and brutality that made the most vicious denizens of nightmares seem by comparison like cartoon villains. Perhaps the remote control used by the fourth Rayshaw didn't merely open the door to the cage, but triggered an attack command in the chimpanzees' programs. Their inborn capacity for violence was surely multiplied, how much, by their implanted control mechanisms. Three shaggy beasts erupted into the long space, not with the raucous shrieks and squeals common to them, but in an eerie silence, as though engaged in some ape pantomime, the rules of which required them to be mute. They scampered to three vertical poles and rapidly ascended, hand over hand, into the jungle of grab bars suspended at three levels throughout the room. Having conjured forth the vicious trio, having tossed aside the remote control, the remaining Rayshaw came toward Jane now from the doorway of its apartment, like a towering and indestructible golem risen from mud to its present form, its shadow repeatedly flying from it as multiple lightning bolts flared down the day. The Rayshaw fired too many shots at too great a distance, but it closed fast and wore a bandolier of spare magazines, and this vast room offered nothing behind which she might take cover. Heart jumping to the erratic pulse of the stormlight, Jane held fast to the discipline learned at Quantico, returning fire with the weapon that belonged to one of the dead Rayshaws, and she saw the golem take a hit in its right shoulder. She threw down the gun when the hammer fell on an empty chamber, plucked a spare magazine from her belt, and snapped it into the heckler as overhead the grab bars thrummed and their fittings creaked from the impact and the weight of apes swinging and swooping, ascending and descending, and ascending again. The animals were so fast, changing directions so impetuously and unpredictably, that she doubted she could kill one, let alone three. And though wounded, moving less assuredly, The remaining Rayshaw still came toward her, its weapon now in its left hand. As Jane drew down on it, the golem shooter scored a hit. She wore no Kevlar. Too inhibiting when maximum maneuverability was required. A searing pain in her left side, above the hip but below the ribcage, hot sting of cut flesh. For a moment, pain robbed her of breath, and she took 2, 3 shaky steps backward. An internal shadow faded her vision, but then fell away. Reflexively, she reached under her sport coat with her right hand, but at once withdrew it, wiping her bloody palm on the leg of her jeans. She was bleeding. So what? Not the first time. However bad the wound might be, it wasn't mortal. She remained on her feet, for the moment able to endure the pain, both hands on the pistol again, which was when one of the chimpanzees swung down from the faux jungle. Perhaps any human form was a programmed target, no quarter given to allies, or perhaps the ape malfunctioned, or maybe the blood from the shoulder wound enfrenzied the animal. For whatever reason, the creature fell on the last Rayshaw, face to face, its legs around the golem's waist, hands clutching, seeming to bite and bite before springing away and ascending a nearby vertical pole. If the distance and the shuddering light did not deceive, Jane thought the Rayshaw, collapsing in death, had been deprived of both its eyes. Chapter 25. The apes, in silence, capering from bar to bar overhead, the absence of monkey house chatter imbuing them with even more menace than otherwise would be the case, enrobed by long black hair, pale faces bearing watchful eyes that flared maroon in the room's light, red in the sudden flashes of stormlight. The pressure of a leftward lean brought some small relief to the pain in Jane's side as she backed away from the center of the big room, where she was vulnerable from every direction. She wanted her back to a wall between two of the large windows. She was halfway there when another ape laddered down the 3 levels of grab bars and dropped at the side of the dead Rayshaw that she had killed on first entering, the one taken in a kneeling posture. The ape jumped on the back of the corpse and slapped its head a couple times and jumped off. In great, though silent, agitation, the beast clutched the Rayshaw and rolled it over again, as though furious that it would not respond. The ape seized the golem's face and lifted the lifeless head and slammed the head against the floor, as though it was a demon arrived from sulphurous realms with an urgent commission to collect souls, but now found, to its bitter consternation, that no soul was attendant to this dead thing that looked like a man but was not a man. It seized the Rayshaw's hair and twisted and tore the mass out by the roots, and with it a grisly flap of the skin and thin subcutaneous fat that sheathed the skull. That grotesque performance, on a nightmare stage of carnage, paralyzed Jane as nothing before had ever done, until abruptly she realized that as long as the ape stood vexed and furious over the corpse, it was an easy target. Clenching her teeth against the flush of pain that the recoil would incite from her wound, she raised the heckler in both hands and squeezed off 4 shots, scoring at least 3 hits. The ape flailed its long arms as if striking out wildly at swarming bees, shrieked once as mortal pain perhaps stripped away its controlling program and collapsed on the Rayshaw that it had been tormenting. The thrumming and creaking of the grab bars at once swelled in volume as the 2 remaining chimps reacted to the death of the 3rd by swinging faster through the steel jungle, dark forms that were at once antic and graceful. Their enormous strength and limberness, the certitude with which they flung themselves and reached for a grip and always found it, was terrifying. Jane pressed her back to the wall between 2 windows, where the storm strobed at the glass. She had used 4 of the 9 rounds in the .45. She ejected the magazine, dropped it in a coat pocket, snapped another one into the pistol. Sweating, trembling, Silently cursing the pain, she wiped the sweat out of her eyes with one coat sleeve and tracked the apes as best she could, not always able to keep both of them in view at the same time. She wondered if they would ever exhaust themselves, and of course, she knew the answer. They were controlled not by their own desires anymore, but by their programs, and they would remain aloft at speed until their bodies failed, or they conspired to distract her and then set upon her. She had known what she'd find on the eighth floor. But although she had read about the power and speed of these apes and understood their potential for extreme violence, she had underestimated them. And she had not foreseen how the chaos of the situation would limit her ability to move and react. Even if the bulletproof windows could be shot out with a long enough barrage, the apes would follow her onto the balcony, where she wouldn't be able to reload fast enough. And if she tried to bolt across the open room for the door by which she'd entered, they would catch her. Besides, the stairwell was not an option, considering that they would be at her heels and able to descend the stairs far faster than she could. She stood with the pistol in both hands but close to her body, muzzle toward the ceiling, her mind racing through strategies. One existed that would work. There was an answer to this dilemma. The world was a maze of mysteries and puzzles, but it was a world of rational design that did not present puzzles without answers. There was always an answer. If only she could find it. Mere minutes old, the storm had not exhausted the bolts in its quiver. The sky blazed as bright as ever, and the thunder crashed as if the mantle of the planet had been cracked wide by some elemental rising force. The lights went out. Chapter 26. In this morning that had been weathered to the gloom of dusk, daylight came sickly under the overhang of the ninth floor balcony and pressed with such weakness against the thick windows of the eighth floor that nothing of the enormous room was revealed, except that for 10 or 12 feet a paleness like the thinnest rime of frost lay on the concrete floor. The lightning, as long as it might last, fleetingly revealed the tiered grid of grab bars overhead, but with each flash, geometric shadows leapt from that steelwork, and in the flickering black-and-white kaleidoscope, Jane could not see where both apes were at any single moment. As each roll of thunder receded, she could better hear the slap of ape hands swinging to new grips, the vibration and creaking of the bar system, and she had no doubt that the animals were moving faster, faster, in a silent frenzy that strongly implied an imminent attack. She couldn't afford a two-hand grip and wouldn't be able to shoot according to her Quantico training. She drew the second heckler and held one pistol in each hand and stared straight ahead into the darkness, thinking furiously. Perhaps she read the sounds of their passage better on some deeper level than she did consciously, but she decided that their animal simplicity must affect their strategy more than would the program that directed them to kill. The program was a macro control. Their instinct, however, worked on the micro scale, threaded as it was through every brain cell and every fiber of muscle and bone. The program told them to kill. Instinct told them how. A sophisticated attack might involve one coming at her from the side with a sudden, startling cry that broke their silence, while the other launched a frontal attack in the immediate wake of that distraction, pinning her to the wall as in an instant it tore off her face with sharp talons and strong hands. But they were not sophisticated. She spread her arms as if nailed on a cross, full length from her body, a heckler aimed slightly up and to each side, a little pressure on each trigger. Peering into the pale light to her right, teeth clenched, braced for the impact of one or both assailants, which would ensure failure, savaging, and a horrific death. The Golgothan gloom of the world outside, the tomb-dark room around her. A sword of the storm flashed, and she thought that she saw a shape hurtling from a mid-tier bar to a lower one. Between the slash of light and the thunder felled by it, she heard a hissing, the nearly mute expression of bestial fury. At Quantico, she had been at the top of her class in gunmanship, hands strong enough to squeeze the trigger on a practice gun more than 90 times in a minute. And now, she beat her best time, emptying both pistols, the pain in her side flaring as the sound suppressors deteriorated somewhat with the rapid fire. She heard brief, agonized screams, but she could not say for sure if two creatures had cried out, or one. If one yet lived, she needed to change positions and reload as fast as possible. Back to the wall, she slid down and sat on the floor, dropped one heckler between her splayed legs, ejected the magazine from the other, tore a fresh magazine from the Velcro system on her gun belt, clicked it into the pistol. This time, she took a two-hand grip. Tall panes of glass to her left and right, palest window forms on the concrete. To her right, a still and huddled mass lying in the faintness of daylight. She caught the foul scent of its feces shed in the shock of death. To her left lay a similar shape of pale light, but no reeking mass of dead primate. Blotting the sweat from her eyes again, she cursed the pain as if it were some sentient creature that had its teeth in her. She peered into the blackness on her left, where some grinning ogre might yet be crouching. Long toes wrapped on a lower grab bar, hands clutching the bar over its head, watching her with vicious intent. She kept the heckler close to her body, aimed left and up. The ape erupted out of the dark, directly in front of her, so fast across the floor and between her legs, hissing in rage, its mock human face suddenly inches from hers, eyes yellow-maroon as though with spectral light shining from within. She cried out, and the ape hissed more fiercely, spitting blood, evidently wounded. Striking as quick as a coiled snake, it seized her head with one hand, tore out her hair, brandishing the trophy with a triumphant scream. As the ape held her wig, Jane shot it point-blank in the chest, expending all 9 rounds, and the creature seemed to be yanked backward and away, as if retrieved by the manipulation of some puppeteer. Chapter 27. Beyond the window, darkened buildings dwindled down the long hill for 2 blocks, perhaps 3, but lights glistered in the rain-swept lower regions of the city and on the other storm-lashed hills. The power outage was confined to the neighborhood serviced by whatever transformer vault or other facility had been struck by lightning. The initial sting of the wound, like a razor slash, had become a more tolerable throbbing ache. As she clicked a fresh magazine into each pistol and holstered one weapon, Jane stood in the watery light admitted by the thick glass, gazing out at the metropolis as it shimmered in the wet. She felt as if she were balanced upon a treacherous escarpment between 2 creations, the one that had been forever, and the one that was being born in these times of utopian change. She could not help but think of Edgar Allan Poe again, the melancholy waters of his city in the sea, where the good and the bad and the worst and the best have gone to their eternal rest. After the coming tide of change had passed, there would be no rest in the new world, only the peace of submission or death. Only the quiet dread that keeps the mouse mute in the presence of the fanged and searching cat. Many in this city had gone to their rest throughout its history, and many more would go, perhaps many of them sooner than they imagined. But right now, the worst of the worst remained alive, 1 floor above her. A wrong that needed to be set right. Carrying a pistol in one hand and a penlight in the other, she made her way among the strewn carcasses to the apartment where the 4 Rayshaws had resided in pitiable privation. Bare mattresses on the floor were their only beds. No kitchen, other than a refrigerator and a microwave. A shower stall, a toilet, a sink of the cheapest quality in a building otherwise elegantly appointed. No armchairs or sofas, no television. a simple table and four chairs where they might have eaten or played the interminable card games with which they passed the time, like engines idling until pressure might be applied to their accelerators. No one had lived here. The brain of each of the four men had been a multifoliate splendor that had been ruthlessly defoliated, reduced to but a few leaves of cognition, so that they existed here, not as men, but as programmed killing machines of flesh and bone. She took off her sport coat and hung it on one of the game table chairs and pulled her blood-sodden shirt out of her jeans to examine her left side by the beam of the penlight. No entry hole. The bullet scored her side exactly where a love handle would have been if she'd had love handles. A 3 or 4 inch gouge, half an inch deep. No arterial bleeding. A steady but acceptable flow from torn capillaries. The heat of the bullet could have cauterized part of the wound. She might lose a pint of blood before she was done. She wasn't going to die from this. The bigger problem was the risk of infection, but she did not have to think about that until later. She tucked in her shirt because it applied at least some pressure to the wound, and she put on the sport coat once more. With his cameras blind, DJ would likely assume she had been killed, but he might not wait for confirmation until the power came on. He might call someone to come to the 8th floor and check. If she hadn't already run out of time, she didn't have much left. In one corner of the apartment, she set the penlight on the floor so that the beam reflected off a white wall, providing meager but adequate light. She holstered the .45, took a sheath from the Velcro attachment system on her gun belt, and withdrew a drywall knife from the sheath. Wilson Faucheur had identified a passageway from the 8th floor to the 9th, allowing her to bypass the vault-like door to DJ Michael's apartment. Using the knife, she cut out a 2-foot-wide, 4-foot-high slab of drywall and put it on the floor. She picked up the penlight and examined what had been exposed. A 4-foot-deep, 7-foot-wide chase, formed of poured-in-place concrete on 3 sides, in which were bundled a stack of inflowing water pipes and outflowing drains that served the top 2 floors, plus a separate bundle of PVC pipes containing electric cables, audio system fiber optics, and whatnot. 4 feet of the 7-foot width were reserved for future service pipes, leaving plenty of room for a determined intruder to ascend from the 8th story of the building to the 9th. After clipping the penlight to her coat, Jane slipped between the wall studs to which the drywall was attached. She turned to face the room that she'd just departed, and she used the cats, horizontal pieces of lumber that connected the wall studs for reinforcement, as ladder rungs to climb up through the chase behind the wall. By now, she was not hampered by the pain so much as motivated by it. In a contest to prove that with willpower she could override the distress of the body. Inevitably, cutting the drywall caused some noise, and making her way upward caused less, but she doubted that DJ Michael would hear anything quieter than a flashbang grenade. The thick concrete between stories damped most sound, and the storm provided screening noise. Besides, when she arrived at her destination, she would come out into a service closet full of panels of circuit breakers and phone service electronics in the corner of the apartment farthest from his main living areas. If the billionaire, his cameras blinded by the power outage, nevertheless intuited that she survived, he wouldn't risk leaving by the hidden stairwell for fear of encountering her. He'd hunker down behind his vault door as supremely confident as he had ever been. At the thick concrete stratum that served as the ceiling of the 8th story and the floor of the 9th, tributaries of the drain and water pipes disappeared therein. She passed through the opening chase into the 9th level, where branch lines of the other utility pipes angled away through the drywall. Braced between studs and sawing with some difficulty, she used the drywall knife to cut an opening into the service closet. There, she played the penlight over the electrical panels and phone company boxes. "Thank you, Wilson Faucheur." From a pouch on her gun belt, she withdrew one of the toys she had bought in Reseda, a patrol eyes body camera used by many police departments, which she'd fixed to a lanyard. She hung it around her neck. The device weighed only about 6 ounces. With its wide-angle lens, it could capture hours of high-definition footage and quality audio. She drew one of the hecklers, switched off and pocketed the penlight, and opened the service closet door. The power company could not already have replaced a lightning-struck transformer, but there was light in DJ Michael's enormous apartment. Evidently, he enjoyed a dedicated generator to provide power in such emergencies. She went after him. Chapter 28. Jane, into the high lair, 9,000 square feet of Olympian grandeur where a mad god did whatever gods with a lowercase g do when they aren't destroying one world and building another. The pitiable circumstances in which the Rayshaws had lived was proof of DJ's contempt for these simplest of his creations. She doubted he would want one of them to share his personal space. And he surely wouldn't keep a programmed ape here on the 9th floor. If there were servants, housekeeper, cook, butler, they would be like the citizens of Iron Furnace, allowed a degree of apparent autonomy, but nonetheless tightly controlled. He would not bring into his personal space servants with their free will intact, when he could ensure his privacy by staffing his homes with his higher-level semi-zombies. Their enslavement was permanent. If she had to kill them to get to their master, she would be freeing them. In the event there was a guest or two, well, any guest was likely to be an Arcadian. She would have to do with them whatever the situation required. Along a short hallway, past a kitchen, she proceeded through a few grand rooms that flowed gracefully to one another, furnished with Art Deco antiques, museum-quality furniture by Desky, Dufresne, Ruhlmann, Suemar. Antique Persian carpets suitable to the palaces of sultans. Everywhere were exquisite Tiffany lamps of the rarest patterns, chandeliers by Simonet Frère, voluptuous paintings by Lempicka, Domergue, Dupas, sculpture by Chiparis, Lorenzel, Price, enamels by Jean Dunant. Here in one residence were tens of millions worth of antiques and art, and so far, not any sign of an inhabitant. How strange it seemed that a man who meant to overturn the past, rewrite history to his taste, and create a future divorced from everything that had come before, should create for himself this haven designed in every detail to transport him to the 1920s and 1930s. Perhaps he perceived in that past age some promise that had never been realized, that he intended now to fulfill. As she passed through this residence of museum-quality art and furnishings, Jane felt a little disoriented, perhaps because these relentlessly elegant items, acquired with so much effort and at such expense, arranged in judiciously considered order, was in unsettling contrast to the 8th-floor horror of Rayshaws and apes and bloody violence. A curious and inconstant tinnitus afflicted her, two or three oscillating electronic tones weaving together, swelling but then fading to silence, like a soundtrack to her disorientation. As on the 8th floor, windows here were of thick bulletproof glass. Ashen morning light, sheeting rain, and a cityscape as gray as if rendered in pencil provided a contrasting background to the warm colors and glamour of these interiors. When Jane entered the great room with its half-dozen seating arrangements, there were as well the sounds of nature's current performance, the periodic grumble from the throat of the storm, the susurration of the rushing skeins of rain, the patter of droplets slanting under the 10th-floor overhang to puddle on the paving stones of the 9th-floor balcony. The double doors to that deep deck stood wide open. As though he had ridden down from the heavens on the currents of the storm, David James Michael appeared at that threshold and stepped in from the balcony. She was overcome with the desire to say, "This is for Nick," and shoot the bastard, right there, right then. She would have done it if she hadn't needed his testimony. He smiled.
"Mrs. Hawk, your persistence and endurance are remarkable.